I realized that it wasn't enough to build a good product. You really have to build a commercial organization around a product to be able to deliver it and actually help it reach the hands of the customers. And you can't do that without building a sustainable business and a good business model that is accepted by your customers. With just a product, it just wasn't enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the Roseman Institute at UCSF, the University of California in San Francisco. Our guest today is Subra Jain, who is a senior associate at Coda Capital. Coda Capital is a San Francisco-based venture firm. It is stage agnostic, which means it will invest anytime from Series A to pre-IPO. They're looking for platform technologies that could transform various markets. Subra manages a healthcare practice at Coda, and by anyone's measure, she's incredibly well-qualified. She earned a medical degree in India, where she practiced as a doctor, before coming to the United States, first to do a master's in the Stanford Biodesign program, and then an MBA at the Wharton School. This gives her insight into every aspect of medtech investment. Enjoy the talk, and if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Welcome, Subra. Thanks for joining me today. We're so fortunate to have you on a beautiful, not rainy Friday winter day here. I thought it would be fun for our listener to first hear your experience. You came from India. You had a degree in medicine. You were a doctor. And then now you are here. You are doing investing with Coda Capital. How do you get to where you are today?
Sure.
How do you decide to become an investor too?
Sure. It's a long and tortuous path. So I was born and brought up in a very small town in India, in a family of doctors, essentially. So for me, going to medical school was a default decision. So I went to medical school in India and was practicing as a primary care physician there. I came to the United States to do a master's program at Stanford in engineering school at Stanford, where I focused on medical technology and was part of the biodesign program at Stanford. That's where I really got exposed to the industry side of healthcare and the technology side of healthcare, and was really inspired to use technology to impact healthcare services and improve the outcomes for patients.
Were you studying engineering when you were studying medicine at the same time? I mean, help us, cause for some of us who never had education in India, how'd that work?
No, I wasn't. So Indian education system, for those of us who are not very familiar with it, is a very rigidly structured education system. And basically after ninth grade, you are preparing to get into a very competitive medical school entrance examination, which is held on an all India basis. And you are essentially, all of your efforts and education is directed towards that. And even during medical school, there's no real concept of electives. And it's very heavily indexed on the subjects that you really need to know in order to be a good doctor and a clinician. And 5.5 years is barely enough for us to do that. Because when we come out of medical school in India, we already have a license to practice and see patients. And in order to equip us to do that, there is a lot of clinical education involved, and there's not really any room built into the system for educating you on physics or math or basic engineering concepts. So when I chose to go to the engineering program at Stanford, I had to go back and learn some of those basics on my own. And when I was at Stanford doing the graduate program there, I was sitting in classes with these students who were engineering grads from MIT and Stanford, and I had to literally go back and take prerequisites off the courses that I was taking at the same time when I was taking those courses in order to really understand what I was being taught in those classes.
I mean, what prompted you to make that decision besides you like to find challenges, but like why engineering, not PhD in medicine?
Yeah, when I came out of medical school in India and started practicing as a doctor, and I really saw the suffering and the problems that the patients and the healthcare system was going through, I just felt that in order to bring any change at scale, my own lifespan was too short for me seeing one patient at a time in order to really be able to make a difference. And I felt that that has to come from some kind of a technological wave and technological progress. And I wanted to be part of that solution, but I felt like I didn't have the knowledge and the background necessary to build that and to facilitate that, to enable that technological advancement within the field of healthcare. And I really have always believed in having a strong foundation on anything that I want to pursue. I view a career, anyone's career, as a very long-term endeavor, and it's really important to have the foundations right and get started on a strong footing. And I wanted to have that for myself. So that was really the motivation behind learning the fundamentals of technology at one of the world's best institutions, and surrounding yourself really with that community. And it was an incredible time at Stanford that exposed me to all the different possibilities and to the interdisciplinary nature of the solutions that will actually solve the problems that are plaguing our society and our healthcare systems.
Mm-hmm. So obviously Stanford accepted you without the engineering prerequisite being in the graduate school, because I think they know that you'll work at it and get it there. How do you, you study hard, but do you do self-taught, or, I mean, how does it work to do the prerequisite? I mean, this is a graduate program, and oftentimes when you're taking a master's degree, they have a bachelor degree in engineering already.
Yeah, so I did some of that work right before I started at Stanford. I did a little bit of that prerequisite work during my time in India, even before I got here, right after when I was still practicing as a physician there. But I did a large majority of that during my time at Stanford, and I was buying books that were much earlier, much lower levels of classes than what I was actually enrolled in, and just doing a lot of self-study. The good thing was that there was a lot of support available on campus in terms of teaching assistants, office hours, and I really took full advantage of that in order to help me pull through some of the higher level education that I was going through.
So you took the master in engineering and you focused in biodesign.
Right.
And so your experience being a doctor probably helped quite a bit.
Yeah. So biodesign is literally the most incredible program imaginable. They bring together a very interdisciplinary team of students, and the program is run by a very interdisciplinary team of faculty members and mentors from the industry. So it's very much in touch with what's going on in the industry and what is the real need from a perspective of development of medical technology. And I thought that they usually try to have someone in those interdisciplinary teams from a clinical background, they try to have someone from an engineering background and from a business background. And I could double up as both the clinical and the engineering person to some extent. And I would like to think that was definitely helpful for our particular team and for the program, as everyone brings different perspectives. Also, the cultural backgrounds, they try to really get a very good diversity of cultural background within the class. And my perspective coming from a third world country where not only the product itself, but also the cost and the affordability of the product matters, definitely informed our decisions through the program.
So from that particular program, did you guys come up with some innovation idea?
Yeah, technology? So we worked on a project that was about anticoagulant monitoring for safety net hospitals across the United States. So all of the safety net hospitals have these facilities called coagulation clinics. And as we know, about atrial fibrillation is a huge problem, and cardiovascular disease is the major cause of death in the United States. There are a lot of these patients on warfarin who need to be monitored pretty regularly, and warfarin is a drug that needs to be maintained within a very narrow therapeutic range, because if the drug levels are too low in your blood, you can bleed, and if it's too high, you can coagulate inside your body, and neither of those are good for you. So there's a need for very intensive monitoring, but given the resource-constrained systems, there's a huge backlog of patients in coagulation clinics. So we came up with an automated system, which was more of like a kiosk-like model, for using a point-of-care machine and some software engineered on top of that in order to enable patients to go to these kiosks, do their INR testing, and then automatically be able to adjust the dosage of the warfarin based on that INR test result, and guide them to the appropriate pharmacy or to the nurse if the results were really out of range, out of the normal range, and there was a need for an immediate intervention.
So what happened to that project? Do you guys pursue it further?
So we ran with it for a little while after we graduated, but we all came, it was a very diverse team. We all came from very different backgrounds. People moved back to their home countries. People took on jobs and moved to different geographies. So we didn't really end up building it very far into a business.
Okay. So, and then did you do something else before you decided to go to business school?
Yes. So coming out of there, I actually joined a digital health startup down in Dallas, Texas, and started doing some product work for them. So I was responsible for a product there, which was around predictive analytics based on EHR data and lab data to predict specific clinical outcomes. The specific product that I worked on was around predicting sepsis, which is an infection in your bloodstream, predicting the likelihood of a patient developing sepsis at the point of time where the patient comes into the ER. And we were able to have this predictive algorithm that could predict the likelihood of the patient having sepsis and initiate an early intervention to administer all of the required things in order for the doctor to be able to treat sepsis and prevent a bad outcome for the patient.
And you were there for?
I was there for a couple of years.
A couple of years. So you're doing more like the product development?
Product development, product management, all of the market research, building the product team with them.
That's all your engineering and your medicine background all come in.
All coming together, exactly. Together. It was a great job, and I really was able to take that biodesign mindset and implement it in the real world.
Yeah. So what prompted you to say, like, okay, I want another 2 years of schooling?
Sure. My desire to learn more, and I am a structured learner, so I just thought that that would be the best way to learn what I was seeking. What happened was when I started with this organization, they were part of UT Southwestern Medical Center, and they were structured as a group, an innovation group within the UT Southwestern Medical Center. But during my time there, they decided to raise venture money and split the organization into different parts. One would be a nonprofit focused on academic research, and the other one would be a startup going after commercializing the algorithms and the products that they had built. In order to do that, they raised a huge round of venture financing, $21 million in Series A. I had the opportunity to be exposed to that corporate restructuring and the venture financing process, and that exposed me to a whole new world of finance, business, corporate structure, which I knew very little about at the time and was very interesting to me going through the process. And hence, I felt going to business school and getting some formal training and dipping my toes into some of these functional areas, which are integral parts of building an organization, would be very helpful. And again, part of building that strong foundation from a long-term viewpoint of a career. The other thing that also was motivating me was I realized that it wasn't enough to build a good product. You really have to build a commercial organization around a product to be able to deliver it and actually help it reach the hands of the customers. And you can't do that without building a sustainable business and a good business model that is accepted by your customers with just a product. It just wasn't enough. And I felt like my medical and my engineering background gave me enough chops to build a great product. But I wanted to go beyond that in order to have real impact and be able to translate that to people.
You feel that you get that skills now from being in business school?
Yeah, I think it definitely exposed me to the world of business. It gave me an opportunity to dabble in some of the business issues that I had seen during my work before. And it gave me the opportunity to do a couple of internships. I worked with an organization called Penn Center for Innovation, which is called PCI Ventures, which looks at early stage technologies coming out of University of Pennsylvania. So I've always been very passionate about startups, about bringing technology and research that is locked into our labs and our papers to market and actually helping it benefit patients and consumers. And I was able to look at the life sciences part of the PCI Ventures organization and help with commercialization of early stage technologies coming out of University of Pennsylvania. Healthcare ends up being a very large part of it because we have a very good, strong medical school at Penn, and a lot of great technology comes out of there. So I think that exposure was valuable, very valuable, and further cemented my interest and my conviction that this is where I wanted to build the next phase of my career. And I really wanted, I was very passionate about startups, creating mm-hmm. companies, helping them get to scale, working with those entrepreneurs. And I chose venture as a career coming out of that experience.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com. So, and then after that, you said, okay, finish, you get all your skills that you think you need, and what's next?
Yeah, and I think coming out of my work with Penn Center for Innovation and an internship that I did during between my two years of MBA, I decided that I wanted to pursue investing in early stage companies as a career path, and decided to move back to the Valley and joined the firm where I am now called Coda Capital. Coda Capital is a stage agnostic investment fund here in San Francisco. We invest across different stages of the company, primarily Series A all the way to pre-IPO. We invest in both public and private companies. Large part of our fund is private, and we also have a small public fund.
I know that Coda Capital did or does still a lot of tech companies, and now also doing the healthcare.
Yes, so I work on the healthcare practice at Coda Capital. We have quite a few healthcare investments, and we also do tech and software investments.
And so tell us more, like what kind of technology that you guys are interested in, that what you found that's something that, wow, this is something that I'd like to be part of.
Sure. So we're always looking for platform technologies in very big markets. We're looking for infrastructure solutions that will enable applications to be built and enable entire industries or entire markets to move forward. I am on the healthcare side, I'm very interested in the digital therapeutics space. I think that is going to be the medicine, the movement in medicine of the future. And
can you tell us more about what you consider as digital therapeutic?
Yeah, so I consider digital therapeutics as software that is enabling a better outcome for the patient. And things that I like to look for when I'm evaluating or looking at a digital therapeutic investment or company are rigorous clinical validation checkpoints to help us understand what will be the eventual impact on the clinical outcome. I'll give you an example. There is a company called Pear Therapeutics that recently got an app approved for substance abuse treatments. So that was a new frontier of medicine where FDA for the first time approved an app for treatment of a disease. So doctors can literally now prescribe software to patients in addition to the pills. And I think that's definitely the way that medicine is moving towards in future.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. Who would have thought 50 years ago that we can use software to treat patients?
Exactly. So that's definitely an area that I'm very excited about. I'm also very excited about life science tools. What I mean by that is any kind of hardware or software that is accelerating and helping the drug development, discovery, research processes. I think the way we develop and discover drugs and the way we run clinical trials is stuck in the past and very antiquated. And there's definitely a lot of room for technology to make that process more efficient, and create more opportunity for us to have treatments that have taken us 10, 20 years to get to market.
So one of your portfolio company, Mission Bio, that is fit in that particular category. And can you tell us more about that particular company maybe?
Mission Bio is a phenomenal company that actually came out of UCSF. So thanks to you guys. And it was part of the QB3 program, which is a program at UCSF supporting biotech entrepreneurs. They're doing single cell DNA analysis and enabling end-to-end workflows for academic as well as industry researchers who are working on genomics sequencing and using that as a platform in their academic research or for drug development.
Yeah, so I know that Charlie Silver was, I remember when they first started, now I feel like they're on their path to success. So any other companies that you're on your portfolio right now that you thought you're excited about? Obviously, there's so many that you're excited about. Just, you know, pick a couple more to share.
Sure. I'm very excited about another life science tools company that we invested in called Berkeley Lights. This was a relatively late stage investment for us. So just to give you a little bit of color on that, Coda Capital is a stage agnostic investment firm. We do all the way from seed to pre-IPO investments, and Berkeley Lights was more on the latter end of that spectrum for us. We participated in their Series E. And that is a phenomenal platform which is enabling cell line development, an end-to-end workflow for cell line development, selling to 15 of the top 20 biopharma companies, and essentially providing them a one-stop solution for manufacturing cell lines for CAR T therapies, which is obviously a huge market for cancer. We're very excited to be working with them on this amazing platform.
Yeah, well, that's nice to see. I mean, oftentimes we see tool companies and it's, you know, finding the right investors to partner with is always very niche market. It's good to hear there's more investor investing in this space.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this space. I think it has huge potentials. The markets are huge. We are in the right cycle of innovation for us to be looking at the tools businesses. And I'm very excited to see more innovation coming out and enabling the genomics revolution that has taken place in the last few years, and the cost of sequencing going down has created a demand for these solutions, which are upstream or downstream from genomic sequencing. How do we make sense of all the data that has been created from genomic sequencing? And then how do we do faster sample prep? How do we do end-to-end workflows before we do that genomic sequencing step? So I think there's a lot of opportunity being created on both ends of that spectrum.
Yeah. So being in a fund that has, you know, focused in tech and healthcare life sciences, you cross in terms of collaboration or do you, everybody kind of separate and do their own
No,
sector?
Absolutely. We are very collaborative. Our investment committee consists of the entire investment team. We make all our decisions together. We talk about every investment that we're making. So it's a very collaborative decision process. And quite frankly, we learn a lot from each other. I learn a lot from seeing my colleagues present and talk about tech investments that they have made. We also are no longer in a world where both of those are really compartmentalized and separated. A lot of my companies on the healthcare side have teams of software engineers, which we can help them hire because of our background and access to resources and networks on the tech side. A lot of them are thinking about the next generation cloud infrastructure or software architecture that they should be building, which some of my partners at Coda have deep backgrounds in, coming from software side of the industry. So I think there are real synergies between the two. There's real learning happening with the collaboration between those two sides. And I'm very thankful to be in a place where I can leverage that.
So what is your process in terms of company getting funding from you guys? And obviously you have the investment meeting. Is that being that each investment kind of being decided by everybody in the team, including the team from the technology sector as well?
Yeah. Typically, I try to be very thematic in my approach to investing, and I would look at certain themes in the market that would get me excited and interested. And I try to develop a view on that particular space before I'm even looking at a specific investment opportunity. For example, digital therapeutics or life science tools. Once I feel I have a good sense of the market and I have a good view on why I want to be investing in that space, I would go looking for businesses and investments, potential opportunities in that space. Some of that is inbound, some of that is out, me reaching out proactively and trying to find the best asset in that space. And once I have found that, I would typically discuss it with one more person on my team, and it varies who that person is, but I would typically discuss it with one more person on my team, just sounding off ideas. And then potentially socialize it with the entire team. And if there is interest, there will be questions from the entire team, which I would explore. And if there is interest, then I would move forward. I would bring in the entrepreneur to meet with our entire team so that we all get a feel for the entrepreneur and how they're thinking about the business. And then we would make a decision as a team.
Mm-hmm. So you've seen, obviously, through this process, you meet a lot of investors and how they present to you. I mean, you were here a month ago giving a talk about what make a good pitch, whatnot. And what do you recommend for entrepreneurs when they come and try to share their story with you? What is the do's and the don'ts?
I think the key is what you said in the question itself. It's actually amazing how many of them forget to share their story. Sometimes they're too focused on the specific things about their business that they're trying to communicate. And I understand that this is your baby and you want to showcase it in the best light as possible in the 30, 40 minutes, an hour that you have with the investor. But a lot of us are very passionate about the business because we want to understand what drives the entrepreneur and how did you get to where you are and what drives you going forward. Why did you build this business and where do you see yourself taking it? That is such an incredibly important part of the pitch and of that interaction, really. So a lot of times, at least personally for me, that's what gets me excited. Even more true for early stage companies where there is little data about the business that we can really analyze and understand. So it's a lot of it is about the founder themselves, about the initial team, and their ability to attract and retain good talent. Some of it is about the market that they're going after. So I would say both of those things more on the early stage side. And then if you are more on the later stage side, then absolutely convey to us any kind of indications that you have from the market about how badly they want your product, how they're beating down your doors to get it, whatever evidence of market traction that you have, whether that is in terms of revenue numbers or customer interest, LOIs, whatever it is that you have, really fosters confidence that this is a real problem you're solving and your solution is something that people actually want.
Yeah, I think you, for your point, like when you're early stage, when you don't have the data, somehow communicating the why.
I think
that.
It's incredibly important. It's just so much of early investment hinges on the founder, who they are, their ability to build this business, their vision of where they want to take it, what motivates them. Are they able to motivate other people to join them and to stay with them through this very grueling process of building a startup? Quite frankly, I mean, I feel building a startup is an irrational decision. It's if you want a good life, a cushy, cozy life, you should never build a startup, right? So why have you chosen to take that rocky road? And why should someone else choose to take it with you? If you can't communicate that, then I significantly doubt your ability to retain and attract a high quality talent.
How do you think this entrepreneur can learn how to tell that, convey that? Is this something that you learn, or is it something that you get coaching, or something you get a lot of practice?
I think before any of those, I think all of those help. But before any of those, I think it's a lot more soul searching and introspection. So go on a Vipassana retreat or to the Himalayas or whatever works for you. But you really have to ask the deeper, harder questions from yourself about why is it that I am here? And what motivates me to be here? Why should someone else be in this journey with me? What is my opportunity cost? What am I giving up? And why am I going to wake up every day and not feel bad about giving this up? Because there will be days when you will really question why I'm here. And on those days, that answer is what is going to keep you moving forward. So I think once you have it within yourself, being able to communicate it is a much easier struggle, much easier thing to do. But I think it is easy to get lost as an early stage entrepreneur in the day-to-day grind of getting everything done and losing that perspective, losing that guiding compass of why you started on this path in the first place, and just having that within you and making that a daily reminder for yourself is incredibly powerful to keep you motivated and to keep others around you motivated. And if you do that genuinely, then it will come across in every conversation you have. You don't really need to do it artificially.
Yeah. I think the ability to be honest with yourself, I think oftentimes it's hard to reach in to ask that question to yourself. Why you're interested? What's your passion? It takes some practice and maturity.
Yeah, sure. I think it's also just like giving it some conscious thought.
Yeah.
And maybe having a conversation with whoever you're close to. That could be your spouse, your co-founder, and delving deeper into, okay, why are we doing this?
Yeah, no, that's a very, I think that's very helpful to hear.
This podcast is sponsored by IO Life Science, a Silicon Valley-based medtech design and development consultancy, transforming your technologies into unique healthcare solutions. For more information, you can visit their website at www.iolifescience.com.
On a lighter note of things, I like to ask people to share, like, what are the, you know, books that you read these days that's fun, that's thought-provoking. Maybe some of the books that you read can be very inspiring for entrepreneurs.
Sure. I think the one go-to book that I keep going back to, and I probably read it at least 6 or 7 times by now, is 0 to 1. I think it's an incredibly powerful, very quick read. And every time I read it, I learn something new. A lot of wisdom compiled into very few words. So that's definitely a go-to one for me that I keep going back to. The one I'm currently reading, Jobs Biography by Walter Isaacson. And I think there's a lot of wisdom packed into how he made decisions. And I am a firm believer in his concept of his theory of things often make sense looking backwards, and you can connect the dots looking backward and not trying to plan everything. And
did it feel that? I mean, you've done a lot too along the way. I mean, from the doctor, and now
I definitely feel my life is literally a real world example of that statement. And I do feel that for me, I can totally connect the dots looking backwards from here, but at the time when I was going through that journey, it really was unclear where I was heading at times. So I think it can be incredibly powerful also for CEOs and entrepreneurs, because a lot of us are always asking the question, okay, why am I doing this? Or what lies next? Or how is this going to lead to X, Y, Z, where I'm trying to go? And sometimes you just have to believe in your gut, and you have to follow your passion and follow where it leads you. And if you do it with genuineness and if you do it with humility, hopefully it will lead you to a great place.
Yeah, no, I think that's very, very helpful for a lot of people to hear. I mean, everybody always have that stories, I think, when you look back, like, wow, you know, it looks like you planned it all along. And because every experience we have, it will add to who we are.
Yeah, and I think it's more important now than it has ever been before. Because, quite frankly, we don't even know what jobs are going to exist in 20 years from now, what career paths are going to look like in 30 years from now. We don't know.
Yeah.
The world is changing faster than it has ever before. And it is not possible for us to go look forward 20 years, 30 years from now and say, I'm going to have that job, because
right.
that job may or may not exist at that point.
Right.
But if you focus on what do you want to learn, where do you want to create impact, what drives you as a person, what are your core values, and if you let your career and your life follow that path, then hopefully it will lead you to a place which you may not see in its current shape and form today, but will be a satisfactory journey and a satisfactory destination down the line.
Yeah, no, I think it's, people always like to ask a little child, what do you want to be? And I always thought that was kind of how would a kid knows, because what they know is so limited at that time.
Exactly. And disciplines are starting to cross, and there are no silos anymore, and the ones that exist hopefully don't
yeah.
going forward. So I think there's incredible value in stretching a little bit out of your comfort zone and trying something that is not necessarily in the road that you have paved for you. Opening yourself to opportunities that present themselves before you and taking advantage of something that might be more serendipitous. I think that has incredible value that some of the people like us who are more type A and ambitious miss out on.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
So you mentioned about try to do something outside your comfort zone. What are the things that you do that's nowadays that's outside your comfort zone?
Sure. I am... doing some boxing right now, kickboxing, which is definitely outside of my comfort zone.
Why is it your outside?
Every time I'm in a class, I'm thinking, why am I doing this again? So that is definitely a very new one for me. I think the other one that I'm trying is, I have never been a morning person, and I'm trying really hard to get into this early morning routine and work out before I head to work. And most people would think that's just normal for them, but for me, it has been a real challenge, and I have to do all these workarounds to make myself on track for that.
How is that working out so far?
I'm doing about 3 days a week, I want to say.
That's pretty good.
My goal is to get to it on a consistent basis, because it's actually harder to do it for interspersed on a more sporadic basis, because then
yeah.
I'm waking up on Monday at 5 and then on Tuesday right. at 7, and then it's much harder. So if I can get into a routine, it's probably easier.
Yeah.
But hopefully, it's one of my New Year resolutions.
I read the book about that. It's Habit of Mind
yeah.
and how you create habit.
It's incredibly hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the key to that is consistency, right? Like
yeah.
you have to just keep reminding yourself of what you're trying to achieve and putting one foot in front of the other and just making progress towards it one step at a time.
Yeah. And sometimes that first step is the hardest one.
Absolutely.
So, well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's so fun to hear your story.
Thank you very much, Christine, for having me. And it was such a pleasure to have a chance to sit down with you and talk about all of these incredible things.